Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
One, two, three, four.
Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about, that's right, the Iditarod. We are a production of Alaska Public Media and KNOM in Nome. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Before we mush on, here's a word from our sponsor.
Support for Iditapod 2018 comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
Happy Monday. We've hit the coast, the Bering Sea coast, that is. Well, we haven't, but the mushers have, and hopefully you're quite a bit more comfy than they are because it's pretty windy and barren out there. That's because the three at the front of the 2018 Iditarod, that's Gerd Wood's Nicholas Petit, defending champ Mitch Seavey, and Norwegian Jor Leifseth Olsom, are all between Shaktulik and Koyuk this morning. That means they'll be crossing or skirting Norton Bay. Officials had said before the race that a lack of sea ice on the coast, because it had melted out there, meant the trail would have to stay more on land than it traditionally has. Then, more recently, it sounded like they would actually be able to mark the trail over the ice. And looking at the Iditarod's GPS map, Petit, then Seavey, then Olsom hunkered down one by one for breaks after crossing the ice of Reindeer Cove on Norton Bay at a spot called Island Point. It looks like they are in fact now traveling over the ice, but they're a little closer to land than the trail shows on the map, so maybe still adding a little distance to that overall trail, but staying on the ice. Race officials have also said they are expecting a winter mushing into Nome and under the Burled Arch late Tuesday or early Wednesday. That would be about a day later than last year and some of the other fastest times, so it doesn't look like any records are going to be broken this year. As I'm recording this early Monday, those three that I just mentioned, Petit, Seavey, Olsom, they've been at the front of the pack and they remain there. Those three were out of Shaktulik very early this morning. That, by the way, is roughly 777 miles into the 1,000-mile race. Petit departed Shaktulik at about 1 a.m., trailed by Seavey at about a quarter to 4, and just 5 minutes behind him was Olsom. It looked like Seavey had caught up to Petit at Island Point, but Petit had been resting. He headed out before Seavey, and now Seavey's out on the ice as I'm recording this with Olsom resting. And we talked about the very bunched-up chase pack in yesterday's podcast, but they've spread out a little. Bethel's Pete Kaiser and Wasilla musher Ray Reddington Jr. were resting in Shaktulik this morning, and back up the trail in order are Travis Beals, Wade Mars, Richie Deal, Ramey Smith, and Linwood Fiedler. A little ways back is Matt Hall, the top rookie right now, though he's a Yukon Quest champ, so not a rookie to 1,000-mile races, but a young guy and a rookie in the Iditarod, and he's reaching territory he has never seen before. Things are still just a little more bunched up behind Hall with Aaron Burmeister, Matt Fahler, Ali Zirkel, Jesse Royer, and Kelly Maxner a little ways out of Unalakleet. So Petit, Seavey, and Olsom, they passed through Unalakleet yesterday afternoon after the portage from Caltag, and they arrived in very different shape, as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports. Zach got a look at them and caught up with them in Unalakleet and says that might have offered some signs of what could be ahead in the last stretches toward Nome.
Mushers reach Unalakleet after crossing a long, historic portage route from Caltag. It's the stretch of the trail where the long, flat slog down the Yukon River finally relents and transforms into the fickle terrain and weather of the Bering Sea coast. When Nick Petit pulls in, the checkpoint is filled with onlookers as he quickly parks his dogs and doles out a fatty meal that they start wolfing down.
I've been feeding him so much, I can't believe how much they're eating. They've been eating better than they ever have.
Appetite is one of the most dependable measures of a team's health and drive. Petit's team looks strong, alert, and energetic, indications that they'll be able to keep up their competitive pace. He rested for several hours in between checkpoints, but says it's worth the commotion here at the edge of town to escape the afternoon's warm sun and get the dogs more rest.
On this race, I've camped more than I normally do, and that's nice because you're on your own with your dogs and all. But I wake up when I start shivering and then I go again. So checkpoint, I can skip the shivering part.
One of the liabilities of being a front runner is all the attention that it brings, particularly in bigger communities like Unalakleet, where locals, tourists, and members of the press mob mushers with cameras, autograph requests, and questions. all at a time when they are sleep deprived and have to focus on their dog care. As Mitch Seavey pulls in a few hours later, his dogs look tired, with the leader meandering on the way toward the race checker. Seavey is having problems with his team. A few were sick, some have minor aches, and one hasn't been eating well. Seavey's granddaughter and son Danny are on hand, and after making headway with some of his chores, the elder Mitch starts running down a list of issues.
All that deep snow and stuff, I think their back leg is really tired.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're willing to go fast when it doesn't require a lot of pushing, but when it's uphill or it's down to nothing, you know.
Mushers did not have an easy time on the Yukon. Seavey is sore and short on rest. He says this year's race has taken a toll.
It's hard to keep your attitude right, you know?
Yeah.
That river was so tough.
Not long after, the third musher to arrive is Yor Olsom. Both he and his team look good. The dogs are perky, and Olsom's mood is equally bright as he briskly pulls off Velcro booties.
Oh, I'm probably sit down and have a good meal, I would think.
Olsom had spent a few hours camped out along the trail, but wanted to stop again to charge his team and wait out the few remaining hours of sunlight.
It's too hot. Too slow going.
For a few minutes, all three of the frontrunners were in the checkpoint at the same time, eyeing one another, trying to glean what the competition is like before hitting the last 261 miles of the trail. After eating, Olsom heads out at sunset, about an hour before Seavey, and in second position behind Petit. In the Iditarod Trail in Unalakleet, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Well, folks in Unalakleet last night checking out the mushers coming into town, and dozens of people there gathered at the community hall to celebrate a legend. That would be Dee Dee Jonro. The musher has been a presence in the small coastal town for more than 3 decades, and earlier in the year she announced that this would be her last Iditarod. But Jonro scratched early from this year's race, saying she didn't feel well enough to adequately care for her team. Sounded like she had flu-like symptoms. And even so, over the weekend, she flew to Unalakleet, where she has relationships stretching back to her days working on herring boats in the 70s and 80s. A few hours after the first mushers reached town, people gathered for food and cake, a few speeches, and to present Jonro with a handmade cusbuck.
People have no idea how wonderful extended family, how good everybody is to each other, and also how you could depend on them. You know, and Unalakleet's been there. I mean, friends and family and stuff have been there for years for me.
Over the years, Jonro has visited to help with Bible camps and helped get together resources for special needs residents in rural Alaska. The community event was organized by a small group of friends, including Paul Ivanov, who says there are several reasons so many people admire her.
Number one, she's a great ambassador for the sport, but I think equally important is she gives back to the community. I could name countless times that she's been to Unalakleet, not for Iditarod. And it's just that kind of giving back that Unalakleet really loves about wonderful people like Dee Dee.
Jonro has started in 36 Iditarods, finishing all but 4 of them and placed as high as 2nd. She did that twice, and it's really great to hear her voice again in this year's race coverage. And we want to hear your voice. We still do, while we still have a couple more days left of the Iditapod. Please send us your questions about the last great race to iditarod@alaskapublic.org, preferably in voice memo form. Today's question is about water.
Hello, Iditapod. My name is John. I live in Anchorage, and I have a question about water. Specifically, how do mushers carry and provide liquid water for themselves and their dogs when they run for so long at temperatures so far below freezing? Thank you very much.
Hi, John, in Anchorage. This is a great question, and the short answer is they don't, at least not for the dogs. When mushers get to checkpoints, one of the first things they do is go and get water. And this could be from a variety of places. At some checkpoints, it's hot when they get there, which saves them time because a lot of what mushers are doing with the water is defrosting meat and mixing in kibble and giving their dogs food that's a kind of brothy, mushy combination of protein and hydration and all the other nutritious stuff that dogs eat. At other checkpoints, it's cold water, and the mushers have to heat it up to do the exact same thing. And at some other checkpoints, it's actually just a hole in the ice, and mushers kind of dip down a bucket and get the water up from there. It's river water, it's clean, but it's cold. That's the case in White Mountain, where the checkpoint is kind of up a big hill, and so mushers stay down on the river, and there's a hole, and they get water from the Fish River. In Anvik, for example, the water's in the washateria, and mushers walk in, fill a bucket from a regular kind of faucet, and then bring it back out. In Nikolai this year, I was really impressed because there were these kind of rigged stoves just for hot water during Iditarod. They were 50-gallon metal drums. There were two of them, and in each one there was a secondary container just for heating up water, and it came out of a little spigot. So mushers would walk over, and there'd be this roaring fire going. It was surrounded by wood to keep it going. They'd turn the tap on, and they'd get water that was, if not boiling, then extremely hot to the touch. As for themselves, mushers do carry personal water. Oftentimes, to keep it from freezing, it's in big insulated thermoses that have long straws, so it can sit kind of down by the handlebars and they can sip at it or in a jacket or something like that. And they'll refill water bottles at checkpoints with potable water and drink it along the trail. So of all the things that mushers haul, water is not one of them, at least not in any major quantity. This is a great question. Thanks.
Great question. Great answer from Zach there. Now, changing gears, but still sticking with Zach, when we talk about the Iditarod, usually we're talking about a spectacle, a massively complicated event that unfolds for most of us on screens or over the radio, maybe on a podcast, and maybe even in glimpses at checkpoints and finishing lines if we're lucky. Underpinning this race, though, are all kinds of chores, tools, training, and time commitments, and we don't really see most of that. It's straw, shovels and buckets for scooping poop, runner plastic designed for particular snow conditions. Competitive mushing involves all kinds of specialized knowledge and equipment that the non-mushing public never really hears about. And alongside it are complicated techniques for dog care, coveted bloodlines in the purchase and sale of sled dogs, and even a few black markets for essential gear. Case in point, snaps. Zach heard a strange story on Twitter about the weird world of dull-seeming metal mushing clips.
Most social media conversations about dog mushing are happening on Facebook, but there's a small pocket of sled dog enthusiasts on Twitter, including someone who goes by the username RuggedArtCowboy.
So I'm Quince Mountain. People call me Q in the musher handler world and elsewhere. And, you know, my wife, Blair Braverman, and I have a kennel together in northern Wisconsin, Braver Mountain Mushing. And it is in the town of Mountain, Wisconsin.
Q and his wife Blair are writers with sizable followings online, and the two of them post a lot about their adventures in the dog mushing world, which is where some of us first heard about a critical shortage in the supply of snaps, those small brass and stainless steel clips that attach a sled dog's harness to the main gang line towing the sled. Essentially, snaps are what connect ropes to dogs.
And it doesn't seem like a big deal. It seems like you could use just about anything. But it turns out, you know, in winter or even fall training, in any kind of wet conditions or conditions where there's little gravel or snow or ice, sometimes even poop gets in them, you want a mechanism that's as simple as possible and that's not going to get locked up with all that grit.
What Q and many others have come to prefer the most is called the Swedish snap.
There's this guy, it turns out, in Sweden with a machine, a little hand-levered machine, and he makes the snaps that are the best snaps, and his machine broke. I think his name is Peter. I'm not positive. I was trying to look back.
After Swedish Peter's machine broke, Q thinks he just decided to hang things up and retire from the whole snaps racket. But eventually, that created a supply shortage stretching all the way back to Wisconsin.
Eventually, there was such an outcry. You know, people were, how can I fix the machine? Can I get the machine? What can we do? You know, we were talking about trying to buy the machine and or reproduce it and make the snaps here. I mean, how hard could it possibly be to fix?
Q says there was a rush on the pet and mushing supply stores where you could get Swedish snaps, and suddenly there were people doing whatever they could just to get a handful to tide them over. That was the situation last fall, when Q was at a training event and spotted a man off to the side with what appeared to be mushing's equivalent of gold nuggets.
He was putting new snaps on his line, and I was like, am I really seeing this? And I got closer, and I said, are those new Swedish snaps? Have you had those a while? Or where did you get them? And they were clearly in a shipping box. He had just gotten them shipped with a bunch of harnesses, so he sort of couldn't hide it that these were new snaps. And he's like, look, I don't know how many there are, and he told me who the supplier was.
When I asked Q about the source, he kind of squirmed.
Well, Zach, I'm a little uncomfortable with that. I mean, I'm happy to talk with you about this story, but it's just one of those things where I don't really feel like I can name names. You know, we can't have everybody going to the same person for the snaps.
And actually, Q doesn't even know much about the source herself. Once they connected, he and Blair went on a shady backwoods odyssey to meet up with her, hoping she'd part with a few of the snaps she was rumored to possibly, maybe, still have a few of.
We didn't actually get an address. It's one of those things, you know, you go past the Herfords and turn left by the old bus, and about 3/4 of a mile past, somebody has a sign, and then you look, and there's going to be a weird breed of Siberian dog that you haven't seen before, and that dog is black, and it'll look at you funny, and then you go to the third shed, you know, that kind of thing. And it was about 1 o'clock in the morning, and so, you know, I think Blair was a little freaked out. We were sort of operating on faith at that point, like getting texts from the person about where to go and when to meet, but she wouldn't tell us in advance.
Q got his foot in the door by asking about other equipment and then slyly pried about the availability of fresh snaps. He says Blair had to tell the woman about herself, explain her goals, her reasons for needing the equipment so badly before the source agreed to sell them some. So it worked. According to what Q's heard, Swedish Peter has restarted his production of snaps. But the shortage hasn't yet ended, and a secondary market has sprung up. Q thought about bringing his supply of snaps up with him to Alaska for the Iditarod and trying to sell them off during the event to cover some of his costs, but ultimately opted not to. That doesn't mean, though, that he's not affected by the forces of mushing capitalism. Q had arranged for a friend to take care of the sled dogs at his kennel while he was out of Wisconsin, and he sort of got hustled.
And this is why I have to be really careful, Zach. So it ended up, it was the night before, he knew I was in a pinch, and he said, well, if I'm going to watch your dogs for 6 weeks, I'm going to need to make tie-out tethers for them, and to do that, I'm going to need some snaps. So it's basically like, you know, a little bit like, I don't want to use the word extortion, but yeah, I mean, I had to drive to his house and deliver the snaps to make sure that my dogs are taken care of. You know, and this is a friend. This is a friend, really good friend. But, you know, you got business is business.
Q says there's some irony in one little supply chain failure disrupting the sled dog economy so massively. He says mushing is supposed to be about self-sufficiency and resourcefulness. And yet, when a metal clasp became harder to get, there was a Lord of the Flies effect that turned a tight-knit community into a cross between the mafia and survivor.
The mushing should teach us nothing if not that we don't need to be reliant on every new technology. I mean, the Amish have something smart going on. You know, we think that the Amish are anti-technology, but what it is, they just want to see how everyone else is affected and wait to see if they should adopt a technology. How does it affect the community? If it seems innocuous, they'll adopt it. But, you know, like the jury's still out on the zipper, right? And maybe we've learned a little bit to rely too much on these metal snaps produced overseas. Maybe we need to be a little more self-reliant.
Even as the Iditarod is pushing competitive mushing to new levels each year, it's still a sport that essentially harnesses the wild power of a semi-trained animal pack. For the time being, that pack is connected to its human by snaps.
Kind of a crazy story, and well done by Zach. So Q and Blair are pretty active on Twitter. They've been following the Iditarod closely this year. Their handles are Quince Mountain, that's Q-U-I-N-C-E, Mountain, M-O-U-T-A-I-N, and Blair Braverman, that's Blair Braverman, B-L-A-I-R-B-R-A-V-E-R-M-A-N. You can find them on Twitter, like I said. And through the magic that is the internet, we're also able to check in on Dallas Seavey? The 4-time Iditarod champion is not in the Iditarod this year, but he's racing dogs right now in Norway, leaving behind a scandal stemming from a positive drug test at the end of the 2017 Iditarod. He's competing in Europe's longest sled dog race, the Finnmark Slopet, which is nearly 750 miles across the wilderness near where the northern tip of Norway borders Russia and Finland. And this is where I want to thank Lynn Rosentrader in Oslo, Norway, and Ben Matheson, one of our trail reporters from last year, who's in Nome right now doing some work with KNOM radio there. We've been hanging on to some of Ben's reporting about Dallas CV in the Finnmark Slopit, saving it for the right time, and Lynn just wrote us an email, mostly to say hi, but she also included a link to the Finnmark Slopit standings and pointed out that, as of today, Dallas is leading the Finnmark Slopit. And as Lynn, who was raised in Alaska, also pointed out, there's a Norwegian in contention to win the Iditarod in Alaska, that's Jor Lifseth Olsom, and an Alaskan at the front of the premier dogmushing race in Norway, Dallas Sivi. Knut Sanderson, a journalist behind the Norwegian magazine Hundesharing, or Dogmushing, and the podcast Trek Knut, spoke with us about this year's Finnmark Slopit set 200 miles north of the Arctic Circle.
The Finnmark race is starting in Alta, which is top of the north of Norway. It's definitely in the polar area. The landscape is quite flat, but it's we have some valleys and some mountains, but it's not that steep mountains as many people connect with Norway. It's very flat race, actually. But it's long and it's cold. There's a lot of wind. It's a tough race, actually. 1,200 kilometers long.
Sanderson says the presence of one of mushing's biggest names in Dallas CV is bringing lots of excitement to the race.
He has been in Norway here for a while, and he has been in the south for a while. But he went up north for a couple of weeks ago, and we all know how well he prepared himself for the race. There was a press conference a couple of days ago with Del Seaway, and he said to the press that he was in there for learning. That was his main issue for participating in FIMA's race this year.
Sanderson says the Iditarod drug test controversy has not overshadowed his arrival.
No, it has not been. I heard some people talking about why he is coming to Norway right now. Is it to avoid the pressure from this case in Alaska right now? But most of the people are very positive and is not focusing on the drug test at all. Actually, very, very little. Much more the fact that he is here. For us, that is huge.
And CV will be taking part in a revamped race that has been lengthened. One new element of this year's Finnmark Slopit is that mushers, in addition to some mandatory rest in specific spots, have 10 hours of required rest that can be divided among the checkpoints.
That combined with the fact that the race has been 200 kilometers longer, make it to a complete new race for everybody. So the race is longer, and the rules about the mandatory stops it change, which means everybody has to scratch the old plans, the old driving plans they ever had, and have to build it up on all over again. And that is exciting for the musher as well as for us that's following the race.
The race started Friday evening in Norway. GPS tracking and leaderboards are available at finnmarkslopit.no. That's www.finnmarkslopit.no. I feel like I've been doing a lot of spelling today on the Iditapod, but that spells the end for us, at least for today. And the end of the Iditarod is nigh. Like I said earlier, the first place team is expected in late tomorrow night. That's Tuesday or early Wednesday morning. In any case, we'll be back tomorrow with our next episode on the Iditapod. You can find us on iTunes and other podcatcher apps and subscribe there, or listen online at alaskapublic.org. That's where we have all the rest of our Iditarod coverage. Our theme music is by the band Sassafras. I'm Casey Grove, and until next time, happy trails.
And anywhere I went to try and get raw milk, I mean, people thought I was like some kind of government agent. It was really hard, and I felt like, wow, I could score drugs in any town I go to probably more easily than I can get this raw milk in my hometown. And that's a little bit how it's been with the snaps this year.